got a sprain or an itch, pain that's swelling or twitch, call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky. I call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky.
Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining. Most radio and TV hosts will make their holiday wishes at the end of their shows. But Carmen and I wish to, well, do things different. We want to wish every one of you a very happy Thanksgiving and the best for you, your family, and friends for this holiday season. If we have time at the end of the show, I will, well, try to sing a Thanksgiving song. We've racked our memories and even used Google to look for just the right song. Now, there are plenty of Christmas, New Year's, and even Halloween songs, but we've really been hard put to find a song specifically written for Thanksgiving. Hopefully, while we do the show, we'll come up with one and do it at the end.
Can you name all of the organs in our bodies that produce hormones? They're all called the endocrine glands and include the pituitary gland and hypothalamus, as well as the pineal gland in the area of the brain, the thyroid gland in the neck, the adrenal glands located over both kidneys, the pancreas, as well as the ovaries and testicles.
But one is missing from our list, and that's the one you just may not have heard of. There are actually four of them, and they're called the parathyroid glands. So you may be asking yourself a few questions. First, what are the parathyroid glands? Second, what do they do? And finally, why should I care?
They are located in the neck, and they do nothing less than control the body's calcium levels.
Big deal, you might be saying. Each gland is only about the size of a grain of rice, and it weighs only 0.001 ounces, just about the weight of a drop of water. But they do a big job. The parathyroids produce a hormone that's called parathyroid hormone, or PTH. An increase in this hormone raises the blood calcium level. It first does this by breaking down the bone, because that's where most of our body's calcium is stored.
PTH also causes calcium release by increasing the body's ability to absorb calcium from food and increasing the kidney's ability to hold on to calcium that would otherwise be lost in the urine.
Normally, the parathyroid gland works like a thermostat in your home. It keeps your blood calcium levels in a very tightly controlled range. When the blood calcium level's too low, PTH is released to bring the calcium levels back up to normal. But when the calcium level's normal or gets a little too high, normal parathyroids will stop that release of the PTH.
Why is this calcium level in our body so important? Well, proper calcium balance is crucial to the normal functioning of your heart, nervous system, kidneys, and bones.
If there is a problem with the parathyroid glands, this can cause hyperparathyroidism. This causes abnormally high calcium levels in the blood. What's the consequence of this theft? Well, the PTH may literally be stealing calcium from your very bones.
Every single cell and organ in your body uses calcium as a signal to regulate their normal function.
Again, what does this mean to you? Well, it is crucial that calcium levels are tightly controlled.
Abnormally high blood calcium levels can damage every single organ in your body gradually over time.
The rhyme, bones, stones, moans, and groans, is an easy way to remember the symptoms of hyperparathyroidism. Bones are weakened as calcium leaches out of them, kidney stones are increased by the high level of calcium in the blood, and then abdominal pains can really be quite common. Many patients also have what we could call psychic moans and fatigue overtones, meaning mood disturbances and tiredness.
And in extreme cases of severe elevations of blood calcium levels called hypercalcemic crisis, patients may present in comatose or near comatose states with organ failure.
But this is not nearly as common as it used to be, as there are routine blood testing and screening for osteoporosis, and many patients have only, well, vague, nonspecific symptoms nowadays. The density of the bone determines the strength of the bone, and osteoporosis is a thinning or weakening of the bones. In primary hyperparathyroidism, the diseased gland makes too much parathyroid hormone, or PTH, which in turn causes an increased breakdown of normal bone.
As the bone breaks down, the bone density decreases, which in turn increases the risk of fractures or broken bones. In extreme cases called osteitis fibrosa cystica, the bone becomes so soft it becomes deformed.
Osteitis fibrosa cystica is a very rare disease in developed countries. The density of bone can be measured by something called a dual energy X-ray absorptionometry test, or let's call it easier, DEXA. Typically, this test measures bone density at three different sites: the forearm, the spine, and the hip. The World Health Organization ranks bone density based on something called the T-score, which is really a measure of how dense a patient's bone is compared to a normal, healthy 30-year-old adult. With normal bone mass, the T-score is between 0 and 1. A T-score between 1 and 2.5 means low bone mass and an increased fracture risk. But it doesn't meet the criteria for calling it osteoporosis.
And finally, in osteoporosis, there is very low bone mass, and that is when the T-score is less than or equal to 2.5. Patients with osteoporosis are in the highest risk category for fractures.
Studies show that after successful parathyroid surgery, the bone density will improve by as much as 8 to 12%, and the risk of fracture will decrease. Kidney stones are stones that form in the kidneys. That's kind of obvious. Although there are many types of kidney stones, calcium makes up one of the most common types. When blood calcium levels are high, it can combine with other chemicals in the body to form those stones in the kidneys.
Typically, these stones pass through the ureters, which are the tubes that carry urine from the kidneys to the bladder.
People will then pass or urinate out the stones, which can be, very painful. Sometimes the stones will get stuck along the way and may actually require an operation, surgery, to remove them.
Kidney stones can cause pain, blood in the urine, urinary tract infections, blockage of the ureter, and even kidney damage.
Of all patients who present with kidney stones, only 3 to 8% will actually have primary hyperparathyroidism.
And only about 7 to 15% of people who have primary hyperparathyroidism have kidney stones.
There are other symptoms of hyperparathyroidism, and these include muscle, joint, and bone pain, as well as muscle weakness. Many of the patients who underwent the parathyroidectomy, that's the surgery, became symptom-free. We mentioned the neurocognitive symptoms before, and those have been associated with the primary hyperparathyroidism and include worsening concentration, worsening memory, especially short-term memory, slower processing of information, decreased motivation, and decreased ability to make plans.
Even though we do not know what causes these neurological problems, we do know that up to 80% of patients have improvement in attention, memory, and reasoning following parathyroidectomy.
So there are many psychiatric or mood-related problems that may be associated with primary hyperparathyroidism. These now include depression, anxiety, agitation, irritability, delusions, auditory and visual, and paranoid thoughts. Since these symptoms can be so vague and hard to describe, the psychiatric symptoms may be the most difficult of the non-classic symptoms to study. There are even sleep disturbances associated with hyperparathyroidism. The signs and symptoms of primary hyperthyroidism can also significantly affect and worsen a person's quality of life.
Primary hyperparathyroidism may have negative effects on the heart and blood vessels. This includes high blood pressure, hardening of the arteries, also called atherosclerosis, coronary artery disease, enlargement of the heart, as well as abnormalities in the normal electrical activity of the heart, also called arrhythmias.
Here, the high level of calcium can lead to calcium deposits in the blood vessels and on the valves of the heart, impairing their function. Calcium can also affect how the electrical impulses travel throughout the heart. And parathyroid hormones may also have a direct toxic effect on the function of the heart muscle itself.
Large population-based studies show that patients with primary hyperparathyroidism appear to be at risk for premature death. Most of these deaths were due to cardiovascular disease or cancer.
Now we finally come to diagnosing primary hyperthyroidism. Here we most often use blood tests. Since the parathyroid hormones control the calcium levels, the two levels normally move in opposite directions. For example, when the blood calcium level is high, the PTH level should be low or on the lower range of normal.
But when the blood calcium level is low, the PTH level should increase. In other words, it is telling the body to absorb more calcium.
So in primary hyperparathyroidism, both levels are elevated. Occasionally, in patients with primary hyperparathyroidism, one or both of these levels may be normal, but in the higher end of normal. Additional tests that may be helpful in making the diagnosis include the blood phosphate level, the vitamin D level, urine calcium levels, and the blood creatinine level, which is actually a measure of kidney function.
The 24-hour urine calcium level will help determine if the individual has something called familial hypocalciuric hypercalcemia, which is a benign condition not requiring surgery.
Vitamin D levels should be checked because low vitamin D levels may be causing a problem called secondary hyperparathyroidism. And we'll try to talk about that on another show. Patients with elevated calcium and or parathyroid hormone levels should also have their bone density tested.
In most patients with primary hyperparathyroidism, only one of the four parathyroid glands is diseased. But in about 10% of affected people, two or three glands are hyperactive.
Finally, in 10% of patients, all four glands are hyperactive. Localizing tests are radiology tests designed to help identify just which parathyroid gland or glands are hyperactive. The most commonly performed localizing tests are a cystamoeby scan and ultrasound of the neck. Now, increasingly, high-resolution CT and MRI scans are also being used.
Even parathyroid biopsy with parathyroid hormones testing may be used if patients are found to have a mass in the neck on ultrasound and it is unclear if it is parathyroid gland or other structure like a thyroid nodule or lymph node.
So apart from surgery, what medical treatments do we have for primary hyperparathyroidism? Well, it's important to know that surgical success rates are said to approach 95 to 98%. Now, medications such as estrogen and bisphosphonates will not cure primary hyperparathyroidism, but could help decrease calcium or even the PTH levels and improve bone density.
There is also a new type of medication called calcium mimetics. These being Sensipar and Cinacalcet, which may lower blood calcium levels and PTH levels.
Now, these are, however, not currently approved by the FDA. That's the Food and Drug Administration, at least for use in primary hyperparathyroidism. So now you can amaze your friends with all the knowledge that you have of one of the least known glands in the human body. This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, and I've been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 33 years. We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Pottsburg Post Office and the Tulsa Welding School. Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. Please call us at 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care. Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show. One sleep disorder puts people at very high risk of Parkinson's disease. What disease am I talking about? Well, there's a sleep disorder that causes people to act out their dreams. It's called rapid eye movement sleep behavior disorder.
Every year, approximately 50,000 people in the United States learn that they have Parkinson's disease, which is a neurological condition that affects a person's motor function and exposes them to other neurodegenerative problems, such as Alzheimer's disease.
Although we still do not know exactly what causes Parkinson's disease, we do know some of the risk factors that can predispose a person to develop this condition. These include a person's age and sex, as well as some genetic factors. Getting back to REM sleep behavior disorder, it occurs during the REM phase of sleep, in which a person's body becomes effectively paralyzed.
This inability to move prevents the person from physically acting out any dream that they may be experiencing, and thus stops them from potentially harming themselves or others.
Interesting, huh? People with RBD do not have this paralysis, which means that they end up acting out their dreams without any notion that they're doing so.
Many people with RBD go on to develop Parkinson's disease, so a McGill University team decided to find out whether an RBD diagnosis could accurately predict Parkinson's risk.
If this ended up being a good predictor of Parkinson's disease, it could, in the future, allow specialists to identify at-risk people and offer them experimental therapies that could delay or even prevent the onset of this neurologic condition. The researchers worked with 1,280 people with REM sleep behavior disorder across 24 centers of the International RBD Study Group. They assessed the participants' motor function, cognitive abilities, and sensory abilities for a number of years. After a 12-year follow-up period, they found that, listen to this, 73.5% of the people involved in the study had developed Parkinson's disease.
Not only that, the participants who had started experiencing motor function issues in this period had a threefold increase in the risk of developing Parkinson's disease or related conditions, such as dementia with Lewy bodies.
Also at high risk were participants who had developed cognitive impairment or started experiencing problems with their sense of smell.
These findings all confirm that the presence of RBD is indeed a strong predictor of Parkinson's disease.
The usual method of assessing the risk of Parkinson's disease, which is called dopamine transporter imaging, is expensive and difficult to perform, whereas the new one, which we just described, is simpler and less costly. One sleep disorder puts people at very high risk of Parkinson's disease. What disease am I talking about? Mother's a sleep disorder that causes people to act out their dreams. It's called rapid eye movement sleep behavior disorder.
Every year, approximately 50,000 people in the United States learn that they have Parkinson's disease, which is a neurological condition that affects a person's motor function and exposes them to other neurodegenerative problems, such as Alzheimer's disease.
Although we still do not know exactly what causes Parkinson's disease, we do know some of the risk factors that can predispose a person to develop this condition. These include a person's age and sex, as well as some genetic factors. Getting back to REM sleep behavior disorder, it occurs during the REM phase of sleep, in which a person's body becomes effectively paralyzed.
This inability to move prevents the person from physically acting out any dream that they may be experiencing, and thus stops them from potentially harming themselves or others.
Interesting, huh? People with RBD do not have this paralysis, which means that they end up acting out their dreams without any notion that they're doing so.
Many people with RBD go on to develop Parkinson's disease. So a McGill University team decided to find out whether an RBD diagnosis could accurately predict Parkinson's risk.
If this ended up being a good predictor of Parkinson's disease, it could, in the future, allow specialists to identify at-risk people and offer them experimental therapies that could delay or even prevent the onset of this neurologic condition. The researchers worked with 1,280 people with REM sleep behavior disorder across 24 centers of the International RBD Study Group. They assessed the participants' motor function, cognitive abilities, and sensory abilities for a number of years. After a 12-year follow-up period, they found that, listen to this, 73.5% of the people involved in the study had developed Parkinson's disease.
Not only that, the participants who had started experiencing motor function issues in this period had a threefold increase in the risk of developing Parkinson's disease or related conditions, such as dementia with Lewy bodies.
Also at high risk were participants who had developed cognitive impairment or started experiencing problems with their sense of smell.
These findings all confirm that the presence of RBD is indeed a strong predictor of Parkinson's disease.
The usual method of assessing the risk of Parkinson's disease, which is called dopamine transporter imaging, is expensive and difficult to perform. Whereas the new one, which we just described, is simpler and less costly. This song is called Alice's Restaurant, and it's about Alice and the restaurant. But Alice's Restaurant is not the name of the restaurant. That's just the name of the song. And that's why Arlo called the song Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. Oh, you can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Now, it all started two Thanksgivings ago. It was on 2 years ago on Thanksgiving, when Arlo's friend went up to visit Alice at the restaurant. But Alice doesn't live in the restaurant. She just lives in the church nearby the restaurant in the bell tower with her husband, Ray and Fasha the dog. I'd like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana. Well, we've come to the end of another Hey Doc show. Carmen and I hope that you've enjoyed the past half hour and have found it interesting, educational, and maybe just a little bit entertaining.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.